from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. For years, Noam Chomsky has been railing against the big organizations that run our lives. In governments, corporations, and militaries, Chomsky has seen a trail of malice, greed, deceit. Lately, he's got a lot more company. Tea Partiers, Occupy Movement folks, and even many a middle-of-the-road un-radical American. There is bitter, disappointed talk across the land, and Noam Chomsky is still setting his deep critique before the people. This hour on Point, uber critic, radical thinker, rebel hero, Noam Chomsky. You can join the conversation. How deeply are these times shaking you? How deeply are you ready to rethink the road we've been on? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Noam Chomsky joins me now in the studio, Professor Emeritus of Linguistics and Philosophy at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, longtime rock star of the radical left at 83, a hero on a lot of college campuses around the world and beyond. He's authored too many books on linguistics and politics to count, and he isn't letting up now. He's published or republished some 10 books just since last October. His most recent are Making the Future, Occupations, Interventions, Empire, and Resistance, and a big pamphlet called Occupy. Noam Chomsky, welcome back to On Point. Great to see you.
Good to be with you again.
So here we are. Do you feel the world turning a little bit your way? You know, there have been times when you've been kind of right in the thick of it, times when maybe the parade has passed you by. What about these days?
There's certainly a lot of ferment and very interesting and important developments in much of the world, including here, including the Middle East.
More openness to a kind of deeper Chomskyan analysis of what's going on? Are you finding that?
I wouldn't say Chomskyan analysis, but there's clearly manifestations of what has long been growing concern about the direction in which the society has been moving, in fact has been moved would be a better term for it. Actually, it's a good description of it in a recent publication of the Economic Policy Institute, which has been the main regular, reliable source of data on the state of working America, it's called. They just came out with a pamphlet called Failure by Design, reviewing what's been happening for the past 30-odd years. They point out that it's a class-based failure. There's a small, very small sector of the population that's done spectacularly well. For the majority, it's been stagnation or decline. And they point out that it is by design. There have always been alternative policy options. And right now we're in the midst of continuing technically not recession, but a period of stagnation, which looks as though it's going to drag on for some time. Unemployment is extremely high and doesn't show much sign of changing. The radical maldistribution of wealth is not changing. It's there's a serious attacks on the benefit system, never very weak, but never very strong now, under decline. And this is, there is finally open reactions to it. That's essentially what the Occupy movement is. And it lit a spark, which took off very quickly, showing that the tinder was dry, people were ready for it. It's similar developments all over the world. It has had interactions with the Arab Spring, particularly Egypt. It's closely connected to movements in Spain and England. Actually, I've visited Occupy movements in Australia, and just a couple of days ago spoke to one in England. And it's a worldwide phenomenon of protest against policies that have been a kind of failure by design. I think the title is accurate.
Let's start with the United States. If the United States economy and society have been changed, maybe fundamentally in some way, by design. Whose design? What design? With what goal?
Well, you can see the goal by looking at the outcomes, which are by now not a much of a secret. I mean, there's a very high concentration of wealth in a tiny fraction of the population. The distribution is heavily weighted by the top, literally 0.1%, a segment so small that it isn't even picked up by census figures. There's careful statistical analysis done to identify it. For the majority of the population, roughly 30 years, a little more, have been a period of pretty near stagnation. People have been getting by extra work hours. The labor force in the United States works by now much longer per year than comparable societies, Europe, even Japan. By debt, which is of course unsustainable, by repeated bubbles, which of course burst. The last one in 2007, we're still in the middle of it. Each one worse than the last. The design is a combination of the government and the corporate sector, very closely interlinked. And they have imposed policies which have led to these outcomes. There was a very significant change in the American economy in the 1970s. If you look at all of American history, it's been a period of growth, industrialization, development, not without regression. There's very sharp regressions, but that's not in very pretty ways, I should say. But that's been the general trajectory. That reversed in the 1970s. The economy was shifted from production continued, but increasingly and very sharply, a sharp increase in offshore production, which is okay for profits, but not very good for the workforce, obviously. And there was a shift from production to financialization. Starting in the 70s, there's been a huge explosion in the scale, profitability, power of financial institutions. By the year 2000, just 2007, right before the crash, it was about 40% of corporate profits. These developments contribute to a concentration of political power. Concentration of economic power automatically feeds into concentration of political power that yields legislation which accelerates the vicious cycle.
Why have things turned in this direction? I mean, a lot of Americans grew up in the post-World War II period with a sense of, sure, there's labor management tensions and all the rest, but in another level, we're in this together, and we've got a great thing going here, and we will create, you know, good lives and share in that plenty. It wasn't perfect at all, but there was a widespread sense of that. What went wrong? Why did that slip away?
Well, there are long-term changes that have contributed to it. So one, which has been studied primarily, many people, but primarily by the political economist Robert Brenner and others, who've pointed out that there has been prior to this shift, steady reduction in the rate of profit in manufacturing, which led capital concentrations to look elsewhere for profit. One way to find profit is to shift production to regions where labor costs are very low, exploitation is very high, there are no environmental constraints, Foxconn and Southwest China,
Asia.
And so on,
and
Vietnam, Bangladesh, wherever it is. So that's an impulse towards offshoring of production. Offshoring goes back very far, but that just was an enormous change.
Does that mean this was inevitable as transportation and communication made production abroad possible, as those countries were standing up and saying, yes, bring it here?
Well, it's not inevitable. I mean, these are developments that are based on policy choices. So take trade. A trade doesn't come out of nowhere. A trade was sharply impelled by containerization.
Container ships.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That, like most of the advanced economy, comes out of the state sector. It was developed in the Navy. The communication revolution also comes out of the state sector.
But how do you close yourself off from the globalization of manufacturing once you have those capacities to make it happen?
You do it by improving the conditions for production for use right here. And there are many ways to do it. So, for example, it's quite concrete. Take the current crash. At one point, the Obama administration effectively nationalized the auto industry, which allowed various choices to be made.
Mm-hmm.
One choice that was made was the actual choice that was made was to restructure it, hand it back over to essentially the same owners, banks, investors, and so on, some different faces, but pretty much the same, and return it to producing automobiles for sale. Now, there were other choices.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with public intellectual and rebel for radical change, Noam Chomsky, about America's future and the world's. He's been writing a lot in recent months, been standing with Occupy protesters in the United States and around the world. Got a big pamphlet out called Occupy and a big new book, Making the Future, Occupations, Interventions, Empire, and Resistance. Several years of his columns gathered there on big, hot topics right around the world where he says, let's not mess around with changing at the margins here. We need some big change. Noam Chomsky joins me in the studio. You're being quoted all over the place lately for some time now in kind of a right-wing media circles talking about Sarah Palin and Barack Obama and what was the promise of the Obama administration. You're quoted saying, I don't usually admire Sarah Palin, but when she was making fun of this hopey-changey stuff, she was right, there was nothing there.
Well, that's correct. It was pretty empty rhetoric. I think that was quite obvious at the beginning. I actually wrote about the Obama campaign even before the primaries, and so I'm not very surprised by much that happened, nor are others. So, for example, as you probably know, right after the election, the advertising industry had its annual convention, 2008, and each year they present an award for the best marketing campaign of the year, and that year they offered it to the Obama campaign. If you look at the business press at Financial Times in London and so on, they quoted executives who were ecstatic about all of this. They said it offers a new model for how to act in corporate boardrooms and so on.
About the marketing campaign, that is.
The marketing campaign, mm-hmm. Which is what it was. It was a very effective marketing campaign. And over the years, part of this trajectory that I've been describing, one of the aspects of it is the spectacular increase in the cost of elections, which, of course, drives both political parties even deeper into corporate profits.
And everybody's in on that. The current trajectory is this time Obama's spending will be huge, but Romney's will be even bigger.
That's right. And what's more, it's also Congress. So it used to be the case that to gain a position of influence in Congress, a chair of a committee, that was based on service, seniority, and so on. Now, increasingly, it's based on a purchase from the party, which offers the positions, but at a cost.
A lot of people worry about money in politics, but we don't sit down with you at this table all that often. So we see that, and we see that its impact is enormous. But take us deeper. What is fundamentally going on here? that has made this country vulnerable to the kind of change that at this point has a lot of libertarians and right-wingers up in arms. It has certainly a lot of left-wing and progressives up in arms. Take us to your deep analysis of what's going on.
Well, it depends how deep you want to go. I mean, the money in politics has always been there. So there's actually very good work by a political economist right here, Thomas Ferguson at UMass, who's shown, reviewed the history for many years.
And but take us deeper, because we understand that that means we are a polity that has accommodated this, that has tolerated this. Why? Take us deeper.
Well, we is a funny term. I mean, it's not necessarily the choice of the population. It has to do with the way the society is structured. There is high concentration of power in certain sectors. Increasingly since the 1970s, as I've mentioned, this has shifted to financial institutions. So they've become increasingly the core element of the concentration of economic power, which carries with it concentration of political power, and their policies, their goals and concerns essentially shape.
We've seen that. We witness it. We live it. What's going on again beneath that, that puts this country in a position that it tolerates this movement? Well, I mean, you look back to the post-war period in one of your essays in the book, and you say, look, there was the time when things were different, maybe not fundamentally different. You've always had a deep critique of this country's economic structure. But what vulnerability in that structure has left the country so exposed now?
The vulnerability, the period of the 50s and the 60s were the period of highest economic growth in U.S. history, and it was fairly egalitarian growth. The lowest quintile did about as well as the upper quintile, higher ones. Still highly unequal, but growing regularly. There was also pretty near free higher education. The GI Bill offered opportunities to an enormous number of students to go, gain higher education, which they couldn't have before. The New Deal regulations on the financial system were still in place, so there were no financial crises. And in fact, banks operated the way banks are supposed to do in a state capitalist economy. They'd take your bank account and lend it to somebody who wants to start a business or buy a house or whatever it may be. That significantly changed in the 1970s. A lot of reasons for it. One reason is what I mentioned. Another one is that the global economy that was constructed by the U.S. and Britain after the Second World War was based on pretty tight capital controls. So currencies were pretty closely regulated relative to one another, so there wasn't much speculation against currencies. It was all linked to the dollar, which is in turn linked to gold, theoretically. That became an unsustainable system by about 1970. That's why Nixon broke it down. The Bretton Woods system was dismantled. The constraints on capital movement were sharply reduced. Following years, particularly in the Reagan-Clinton years, the regulatory system was pretty much dismantled. As a result, you get banking system turned to something quite new and different. Not totally, it had always been there, but it turned into what many people call a casino. It's investment banks can make risky loans, high profit, ultimately. It may crash, but then they have a government insurance policy. It's called too big to fail, which enhances the underprices risk, essentially. There's also inherent problems in market systems, which are well known. So in a market system, you take account when you enter into a transaction, you don't consider what are called externalities. So like you sell me a car, let's say. We pay attention. If we're paying attention, then we'll each make a good deal for ourselves. Mm-hmm. But we don't take into consideration the cost to other people. And there is a cost. more cars on the road, more pollution, higher gas prices, congestion. Those are externalities, and they add up. That can mean a lot, but they're not part of the transaction. Suppose you're a Goldman Sachs executive. You make a transaction. You try to cover your potential losses. You don't worry too much because if it crashes, as it did in 2007-08, the government will step in and bail you out. That's the government insurance policy. But there's something that you don't take into account. It's called systemic risk, an externality, the danger that if you collapse, if AIG collapses, maybe the whole system will come down. That's not considered. So that's an externality that's not considered. That tells you that functioning market systems are driving towards dangerous outcomes. Actually, the worst of them is not in the case of systemic risk in financial institutions, the taxpayer can come in and bail you out. But there are worse ones. One of them is environmental destruction. So if you're your corporate executive deciding how to disperse your investments, you don't take into account the fact that it may destroy the environment. We see that right at the moment. We're in a major crisis for that reason. In this case, there's nobody to bail you out. If you wreck the environment, that's it. So right now, for example, there's a lot of euphoria, enthusiasm about the availability of massive new sources of hydrocarbons from
fracking,
other sophisticated techniques. You look back at President Obama's State of the Union address, he predicted maybe
all of the above.
A century of maybe we'll move towards energy independence. The business press and others are full of excitement about it. It'll change the world. The United States will be Saudi Arabia. It'll maintain its hegemony and so on. There are some concerns raised kind of at the margins about local environmental effects, so destruction of the water supply and so on. But there's another consideration which is barely mentioned. What kind of a world is it going to look like in 100 years after increased use of fossil fuels? Well, we have pretty good estimates of that. Not perfect, but pretty good. And they look pretty grim. That's an externality. So if we destroy the environment for our grandchildren, that's not a fact. That's not a consideration that's taken into account in making decisions.
An externality, but one that we and they would live in. You line up all these threats in your writing over recent years. And as you describe them, they're about as big as can be. And we're in the middle of crises on almost all these fronts, economic, environmental. You include nuclear in that number.
Yeah.
We'll look at those. But what is your fundamental prescription for people listening right now and maybe more open to thinking broadly today than they've been in their lifetime about the change in political posture, start with this country, that might lead toward a more promising future in your view, Noam Chomsky?
Well, I think there are many steps that can be taken. We were sort of on the verge of discussing one before the break. So take, say, the auto industry again. One option that could have been explored, I think pursued, was instead of taking the course that was followed, to turn the industry over to what are called stakeholders, the workforce and the communities. Let them own it and run it, maybe need some federal support, though much less than was used probably, and have it be converted to production for use.
People will look back to the Soviet Union or China before it brought in market forces or India before it brought in market forces and say that's a recipe for stagnation.
But this is nothing like what happened in the Soviet Union.
Why not?
There was no Soviet Union was even more remote from socialism than the United States is. The fundamental principle of socialist ideals way back is that the workforce should control production. Workforce and that you should extend democracy to the economic system. Soviet Union was exactly the opposite. The workforce had no control over production. In fact, you look back to 1917, 1918, the first moves that were made by the Bolshevik leadership were to undermine and dismantle the popular structures that developed in the pre-takeover period.
Conservatives will say, Noam Chomsky, that's inevitable.
No,
when you
not.
Get into stakeholder, stateholder.
No, why is it inevitable? In fact, we can see right in front of us that it isn't. Take, say, Spain. Front pages now.
Mm-hmm.
Spain has
bailout.
All sorts of problems. Actually, there's one component of the Spanish economy that's doing quite well. Big one. Big conglomerate. No unemployment, no major financial problems, banks, production, hospitals, schools. It's Mondragon. It's worker-owned. And it's doing extremely well. In fact, there's analogs here, not on that scale. So there's an enterprise system developing. It's substantially around Cleveland. Not huge enterprises, but a fair number of them, which are worker-owned, community-owned, producing for use, mutual support, part of a much broader cooperative movement. They're doing quite well. Now, this is not anything like – this is the opposite of the Soviet system. China was totally different. So that's just not an analog. The question is, should we have democratic control of decision-making that matters for people's lives, beginning with what's produced, why it's produced, how it's distributed? This is as American as apple pie. You go back to the early stages of the Industrial Revolution here, right around New England, where there was quite a free press, labor, and other press. It was just taken for granted that the phrase was, those who work in the mills should own them.
Well, I mean, you say as American as apple pie, and certainly that sentiment has been there for a long time, but it's also been the point at which the billy clubs have come out and Bread and Roses Parade and all the rest.
That's right.
I mean, there are a lot of things that are American as apple pie, maybe.
That's right. In fact, if you go to, say, Western Pennsylvania about a little over a century ago, there were basically worker-run towns, worker-run industry, and so on. And it was crushed by force. So sure, in fact, the U.S. has a very violent labor history, much more so than comparable countries.
I want to come back and look at Wisconsin in those terms. That we have a lot of listeners calling in for you. Noam Chomsky is with us. And if I may, let's go first to Laura, calling from Brighton, Massachusetts. Laura, you're on with Noam Chomsky.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Professor Chomsky.
Hi.
Professor
Hey.
Chomsky, I'm a big fan of your work, and I'm vacillating between voting for Jill Stein, the Green Party presidential candidate, whom I know you're backing, or President Obama. I'm wondering if you could explain your support for Jill Stein. Has President Obama not been receptive enough to the Occupy movement?
Well, actually, I think that was a little misdescribed. I did support Jill Stein for the primaries.
Green Party candidate for the presidency.
For the primaries.
Mm-hmm.
For the presidential choice, it's different questions arise. And they, frankly, I don't think it's a huge issue. There's some difference between the parties. My view, a significant difference. But they're pretty much the same on the matters that we're discussing here, the fundamental issues. But there is a choice. And if Massachusetts, where I'm speaking, was a swing state, I would reluctantly vote for Obama, simply because the alternative is very dangerous, I think, but without any illusions and without any enthusiasm.
By the alternative, you mean a Mitt Romney candidacy at this point?
And it's not just Romney. Remember, the president who's elected brings with him in this case, a panoply of advisors, supporters, backers, constituency, and that significantly affects policies. You want to have a sense of what a Romney victory would be? Take a look, say, at the Paul Ryan budget, which he supported and which Republicans support in almost lockstep uniformity. That would pretty much destroy the country, in my opinion.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with public intellectual and rebel for radical change, Noam Chomsky, about America's future and the world's. He's been talking and writing about deep change for a long time. More people may be open to at least considering today than in many years. He joins me in the studio. We've got lots of callers for you, Noam Chomsky. Lincoln, Nebraska, Eric is calling. Eric, you're on with Noam Chomsky.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. It's an honor to speak with Noam Chomsky. I would like to know how he feels about, like, maybe regionalization versus globalization. Maybe in the last depression, we had a lot of, you know, communities acting together and maybe also creating their own value-based currency. I do not believe, like, we should go back to a gold standard, but maybe have currencies that are valued with certain communities, such as, like, maybe electricity-based currencies. And also, one quick question. Do you support an extensive audit of the Federal Reserve? And that'll be all. I take the answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric. Noam Chomsky.
I think it makes sense for the Federal Reserve to become more transparent, more open to inquiry. In fact, we had a good illustration of that just a couple of months ago. The Federal Reserve, which is partially open, does release transcripts after half a dozen years or so of the main meetings. And the 2006 transcripts were released, and they were quite interesting. This is right on the eve of the crash, and there was just a great self-congratulation about how magnificent the economy is. Everything's working wonderfully. Alan Greenspan is one of the greatest economists in history. Virtually no mention of the looming housing crisis, which was already huge at that time. Trillions of dollars, maybe $8 trillion of dollars of paper wealth, a huge bubble. Nothing was done about it because it wasn't noticed. Well, it would be useful for the population to know that the people who are planning and directing the economy are so trapped in what amount to religious beliefs that they can't see what's in front of their eyes. That would be important to know. But in fact, that can be known even without the transcripts because there was a fringe of economists, people like Dean Baker, a couple of others who've been pointing this out all along. So it could have been seen. But, yeah, it would be good to have it in general for things to be more open. As to the general point, regionalization, I should say I'm kind of intuitively sympathetic to it. I'd like to see decision-making kind of lower to the ground. But you have to remember that we're living in this world, not some imaginary world. And if the power of the federal government is reduced, as in principle I'd like it to be in some other world, if it's reduced in this world, a vacuum is created, and that's filled, and it's filled by by unaccountable private power. So the talk about, say, devolving decisions to the state level, that's very attractive to concentrated private power because states are much easier for them to control than the federal government. So you have to ask yourself, what do decisions mean under the existing conditions of distribution of power? And that leads to dilemmas. Maybe local currencies are okay for a particular community, but you can't run a contemporary economy that way, or certainly a global economy. So those considerations always have to be kept in mind. I don't think there's necessarily simple answers. Take, say, Europe, which is quite interesting in this respect. In Europe over the past couple of generations, there's been a move towards integration and centralization, and it carries its problems. You can see them.
You're talking about the
EU.
Today. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Rather significant problems.
Significant problems. On the other hand, a lot of progress. So it's part of the problem of the European Union that is not too much discussed is that it was implemented in a fairly humane fashion. In fact, it's kind of striking to compare it with the integration of North America, which proceeded approximately the same time. In Europe, the poor countries, which are now poorer countries, the countries of the South, which are in trouble, Greece, Spain, periphery, Ireland, Portugal, before they were introduced into the European Union, Europe carried out policies to try to bring them not quite to the level of the rich northern societies, but kind of within shouting distance so that it wouldn't have a destructive effect on the lives of northern workers.
But now people look at that and say that was an enormous exercise in unrealism. That was built on debt. That is the very model of the unworkable affiliation.
It's a mixture. In many ways, it was very positive. So those countries have improved enormously with compensatory funding, with subsidies, which have...
But if you can't afford it, if it's a debt bubble that you can't sustain, well, how real is that progress?
Take a look at the debt bubble. So take Spain again. Spain had a pretty close to a balanced budget 5 or 6 years ago. The crisis was caused by bank malfeasance. Same in Ireland. The Irish economy was partially built on sand, but it was doing moderately well. The banks went totally wild, and the government decided to bail them out, meaning the taxpayer bails them out, which is a big hit to the society. Same happened in Iceland, where their answer was to simply default.
Great scale. So you're aiming at the market dynamic here again. I mean, how far do you want to go in reining that in?
Well, far enough so that it doesn't lead to the harmful consequences that are quite predictable, like the ones we were talking about. Ignoring externalities may destroy the possibility for decent survival. And in general, the question is who should be making the decisions. To get back to this caller, I'd like to see them as local as possible, but you have a complex society to deal with. And if gaps, if you can't call on the federal government to make decisions in our world, those decisions will be shifted over to unaccountable private power, which will cause even more problems, just as the ones we're talking about.
Of course, at this point, even the federal government is closely aligned very often with private power.
Absolutely.
Dave in Des Moines, Iowa. Dave, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Noam. Hey, I was heavily involved in the Occupy movement here in Des Moines, Iowa. And I noticed the same kind of things that were taking place in the 80s when I was doing work in Central America. The movement blew apart almost instantaneously. It was co-opted by the Ron Paulers. You could see the footprint of Koch Brothers influence money. My question to you, Noam, is how do you keep it together? Where the rubber hits the road, theoretically, how do we bring everybody together? Consensus doesn't seem to work. There's many blocks to consensus. When I got my FOIA things back from the 80s, there were 33 different government agencies monitoring us, so they're really scared of us, the United States citizens, regaining our power. So many things are brought to bear by people who fundamentally don't understand and are innocent about how much they do not want us to get it together. How do we keep it together, Noam? Go down together. Thanks. Bye.
Thank you, Dave. Noam Chomsky.
Well, I think your phrase, people who don't understand, is critical. Now, there's a way to deal with that. Education, patient, educational, organizing activities to help people understand better. That's what activism is about. And it's difficult. It's going to meet with government repression. Power systems don't go away quietly. But it can be overcome, and it has in many ways.
But here's Dave. He's just come out of it. It sounds like out of the excitement that he felt 6-8 months ago, and then the headwinds and the fracturing. It's not so obvious to him. It doesn't sound from his voice how it holds together.
It's never obvious. But just take a look at the achievements that have been made. Say, take women's rights. You go back to the abolitionists. They were calling for women's rights. It wasn't until the 1970s that significant progress was made on that, well after a century later. The civil rights movement. I mean, we date it to the early 60s, which is not false, but it was going on for decades, a century before that, beaten back, finally broke through.
But this time, if I may, you're talking about a century of crisis in front of us, of economic, environmental, nuclear threats that you put the stakes about as high as they could be. You write in all of your essays about how this struggle to keep power close to the people is endless. It goes on and it never ends. So if this is a long-term struggle and you're talking about 100 or 150-year periods of time looking at civil rights, How do you line up the ascent of the kind of power you would like to see exercised with this timetable, which is frighteningly truncated, as you describe it, of crisis and emergency?
If anybody had an answer to that, they would have told us a long time ago. The only answers that there are, just by logic and by history, is hard, dedicated work. Recognition that it's not going to be instant gratification. Things don't come quickly. They come. You can gain victories by serious dedication, but they're going to be limited.
Take
the civil rights movement again. I mean, it's useful to look at real cases.
Mm-hmm.
Take, say, the civil rights movement. I happen to have just come back from Greensboro, North Carolina, small town, but mm-hmm. very famous.
Sure.
In 1960, a few black students from a black college in Greensboro, decided to sit in at a lunch counter at Woolworth's. They were, of course, arrested, pretty brutally taken away. That could have been the end of it, but others came. Freedom Riders started. SNCC was formed. People came from the North.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty soon you had a substantial mass movement, which had consequences, undoubtedly. It's a very different place now from what it was 50 years ago. On the other hand, it didn't gain its goals. So take Martin Luther King, a highly significant figure. When on Martin Luther King Day you hear, elevated rhetoric, mm-hmm. which usually terminates with his I have a dream speech.
Mm-hmm.
There was another I have a dream speech, which is rarely mentioned and I think is much more important. That was the evening that he was assassinated. He was assassinated in Memphis, which I was...
Workers on strike, sanitation workers.
And planning to organize a movement of the poor, not just poor blacks, but mm-hmm. the poor. That wasn't going to be tolerated. He was addressing class issues. He was killed. There was supposed to be a march on
mm-hmm.
Washington.
Mm-hmm.
It was carried out led by his wife. They made it to Washington. They set up a tent city, Resurrection City. The Congress, the most liberal Congress in American history,
mm-hmm.
called in the police. They smashed it up in the middle of the night and drove the people out of Washington.
What does that tell us? You talk about looking at real history, real examples. I mean, Americans rallied, though by no means unanimously, around pushing back against racism. But on this issue of going for workers' rights, worker control versus a lot of market forces that you described, do you think Americans will rally around that?
We'll see. You couldn't have predicted the civil rights movement. You couldn't have predicted the Occupy movement. You can never predict the course of popular movements. In Tahrir Square, when a few people gathered in January 25th, 2011, they didn't know. Nobody knew what would happen. When the young kid sat in at Greensboro, you couldn't know what would happen. But we do know that if you work hard over a long period on these things, you can gain rights.
Saad in Los Angeles is calling. Saad, you're on the air with Noam Chomsky.
Hi, Tom. Two related questions for Professor Chomsky regarding the current situation in the Middle East. The first one is, in his opinion, what does he think is the main reason preventing the United States and NATO from taking military action against the regime in Syria, as they did in Libya? And a second related question, does he think that the Russian and, to some extent, the Chinese backing of the regime in Syria could possibly signal a new era of balance of power in that region of the world?
Time is short. Thank you, Saad. Noam Chomsky, thank you, Saad. No.
Well, the simple answer to why NATO doesn't do anything is because they don't want to. If the United States and its allies wanted to intervene, they wouldn't care one way or another about a veto at the Security Council. They've ignored the Security Council many times. In fact, I suspect they actually welcome the veto because it provides a pretext for not doing anything. And the reason why they don't intervene is because it's not a simple situation. So if you look, there's no time to go into it, but if you look carefully, take a look at what the observers are actually reporting, or what refugees are actually reporting.
And in Syria.
Yeah, go beyond the headlines. You find it's complex. If we had time, I'd go into it. But there's a serious danger There is a civil war going on, and there's a danger that it might become far more serious, have regional consequences. Both sides are involved in pretty ugly actions. And I don't know of a single specialist on Syria who has any concern for the people who's calling for military intervention. In fact, they're counseling against it because the consequences could be worse than the ugly reality.
New balance of power, Saad asks. Russia, China holding the stick here?
Yeah, I don't think so, really. I mean, it isn't a superpower confrontation. As I say, NATO doesn't want to intervene either. There are differences all over the world between the great powers, but I don't see that. There's a conflict developing between the United States and China, but it's a different kind of conflict. It doesn't have to do with Syria. It has to do, if you look closely, with concern of the United States that it may be denied access to the waters right off the coast of China. So the Leon Panetta, defense secretary, pointed out recently our big problem with China is that they're carrying out area denial programs which will keep us off their coasts. Notice it's not off the Caribbean. It's not the Caribbean. It's not Massachusetts Bay. The United States is trying to maintain a global position of dominance, which it in fact had in 1945 and has been losing slowly ever since and cannot sustain.
American control, global climate, global economy, the American people. Noam Chomsky looks at all of them. Our time is much too short today, but we're grateful to you for coming in. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Making the Future by Noam Chomsky. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.